Welcome to a third season of A Healthy Dose, a bi-weekly podcast hosted by Steve Krause, healthcare partner at Bessemer Venture Partners, and Trevor Price, CEO of Oxygen Partners and general partner of Town Hall Ventures. The guys shoot the shit about healthcare, usually with leaders from the entrepreneurial, executive, investment, and policy political worlds. Interspersed with that, they rip each other about music, clothes, valuation, and investment track records. Everybody says, say something, say something.
So I think most guests of the Healthy Dose know that like 99.9% of the really good guests are ones that I bring to the show. Steve doesn't add a lot of value to that. And yet today I give him credit.
I reached across the aisle.
You went across the aisle at a time of unprecedented, you know, political acrimony and just outright absurdity. And you got someone who was highly, highly, highly influential inside of the Trump administration. Pretty storied career and policy as a lobbyist in the life sciences industry and healthcare mind. And I thought it was a great conversation. It was civil.
Yeah, I want to thank our mutual friend, Darren Newhall, for connecting us with Joe. Joe Grogan was our guest. And I have to say, it started out, Trevor, people know Trevor's politics, and they also know Trevor can ask a lot of great questions. And a couple times your face got red, Trevor. I was a little worried that we were gonna start getting a shouting match. But I give you credit. I give Joe credit. I felt a little bit like the moderator that we went through without any yelling. We really did talk a lot about a lot of interesting health policy, frankly, social policy. And to Joe's credit, at times he sounds like a hardcore conservative, and at times he sounds like a Democrat. I think I called him out on that. It's pretty interesting. It was a really unique conversation.
Yeah, I think with the ACA test looming, with the election looming, with, you know, just so many unanswered questions around COVID and the administration's response, I give him credit there too. He did not play, you know, loyal partisan in discussing, you know, how we've responded. Now, he said that we needed to overhaul many of our government healthcare organizations like the CDC, like the NIH, but I thought he was honest, and I wish we had more people like him.
He also said it's insane that people don't wear masks, right? And that vaccines are becoming politicized. So
I think we're doing more politics this fall, right? I mean, just for healthy listeners, we're going to do a little bit more politics in advance of the election.
The election and after the election. So it's a unique time in American history.
That should be interesting.
Oh.
All right, Steve, we are reaching to the other side of the aisle in a true bipartisan fashion today and are thrilled to welcome Joe Grogan to A Healthy Dose. Joe has been a very close advisor to the Trump administration. He was director of the Domestic Policy Council, associate director of health programs at OMB, and on and on and on. It's an amazing background in healthcare, life sciences, and policy. And so I want to harken back to the days of Lindsey Graham and Joe Biden and Ted Kennedy and Mitch McConnell and Tom Daschle and Bill Frist and, you know, bipartisan collaboration, and start out, Joe, and be like, very simply, how the hell did we get to where we are right now in this state of politics, and particularly around healthcare and the virus? And just give us your read on why we are where we are today.
You know, it's a great question. I think there's a lot of cross currents that have occurred over, you know, my time watching politics as an observer and then getting involved in it. I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative, so this is my viewpoint. But one of the earliest memories I had, you know, in politics was Reagan's election in 1980. I was 8 years old. One of the most contentious periods of that 8 years domestically was the Robert Bork confirmation hearing, which is interesting because people are really viewing the Amy Coney Barrett nomination as the full circle of what conservatives had wanted to achieve with Bork's nomination. And Bork's nomination was so contentious and was, from a conservative perspective, from a Republican perspective, viewed as a watershed moment in that there was no bipartisanship, no civility when it came to these Supreme Court wars, followed up a few years later with the Clarence Thomas hearings, also ugly as sin. And then, you know, there were intervening events with Newt Gingrich taking over the House and really throwing over the old guard of the moderate establishment Republican wing in the House of Representatives.
Emergence of the Tea Party, right?
No question.
That, I guess.
No question. And the current corollary with the rise of the sort of Antifa, BLM, progressive stew, which I don't think we fully understood what that is yet. I think you're going to need a little bit of distance, another year or two, to see where that goes as far as that movement is concerned and where that energy is directed. But there is no question.
We're going to keep this civil, but do you equate Antifa and the Black Lives Matter movement as equivalent movements?
Not at all. But I think that there was a period where the protests around Mr. Floyd's death and the police brutality all justified, where there were people that took advantage of that and there was violence associated. And I don't believe that those people were necessarily motivated by racial justice motivations or police brutality motivations. And I think there is something going on the left right now that we don't fully understand. And it's going to take a little while, a little distance to pull that apart and see where those lines are. And if, you know, Joe Biden's elected, does all that energy dissipate? Does it stay active were to challenge him with the same energy that is challenging the Trump administration? But, you know, just as the Tea Party got channeled into Trump's election, it's going to be interesting to see where this progressive BLM and to some extent the Antifa energy goes. Does it get channeled into more progressive activism on the left or somewhere else?
Hey, Joe, can I ask one question, though? I want to just push on what Trevor says. And I feel like the politicization, that word's always hard, of combining Antifa and BLM versus the policy of, you know, yeah, anybody who's radical, whether it be on the right or the left, right? Because there were also probably radical right who were taking advantage of this as much as there were probably radical left. I agree with you around the violence. I feel like it does a disservice. And this is not attacking you. I just feel like politicians do this all the time. They take a public policy matter, which is Black Lives Matter, which is really important, right? And so intertwined in the history of America. And then they sort of do it injustice by combining it with something like Antifa. And you can argue that the left does the same thing to the right, right? And so how do we get, I think it's the root of Trevor's question, like, how do we get out of like politicizing really valid public policy issues? Because in essence, it just raises people's guard to say Antifa and BLM, they're so different, right? Just as I'm sure it raises people's guard to say radical white
terrorists. Right-wing conservatism is not white supremacy. It's not the same thing. Like, I have immense respect for my conservative friends who have different political points of view around social issues and economic issues. They're not white supremacists. Just like the people who are supporting Black Lives Matter are not radical left-wing agitators.
Yeah. So how do we get here? This thing that we're stopping you on is almost the issue, right? Which is like politicizing important policy matters to the extreme, right? For advantage.
Well, I'm not trying to do it for advantage. I'm pointing out that on Memorial Day weekend, a human being was killed on video, and it unleashed a stream of justifiable protests. For me, when I saw that, it looked to me like that human being was murdered by a man in uniform. I understand that rage. I understand that protest. I understand that movement to change that dynamic. I get that. I get that as a conservative who's suspicious of the state. That's why I'm a conservative. I don't want the arm of the law, the knee of the law on anyone's back, regardless of color. That's one of the reasons why I'm for limited government. However, I don't think anybody can, it is not politicization to say that some of those protests that were born out of the BLM movement, that was catalyzed by the murder of that individual, did not turn violent. I am in Washington, D.C. D.C. is a ghost town downtown. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of destruction associated with those protests that were sold as this is about racial injustice, this is about police brutality. I would like to think that the Martin Luther King tradition of civil disobedience and protesting for civil liberties can continue without things being burnt to the ground, people being punched, things being thrown. That is why I attribute that violence that was at those protests to Antifa and not to BLM.
I just think if you look at it from the opposite side, there's equal agitators on the right with semi-automatic weapons and with Confederate flags. And we see the answer to this is not that one side is wrong. You know, there are good people on both sides comment. Actually, it should be there are bad people on both sides. There are people who have bad agendas and bad objectives on both sides. They're the vast, vast minority of the population, particularly as it relates to Black Lives Matter or other. There are people who are out there to agitate. And I agree with you. My block was severely damaged during the New York City riots. That was not a Black Lives Matter riot. That was I don't think it was Antifa either, by the way. It was economically driven, and it was scary, and it was wrong, flat out.
I would agree with you about your point about the right, and I'm happy to have that discussion about the agitation and the wing nuts and the racists on the right that frequently hijack debates and hijack protests, too. I mean, that does happen. It happens far too frequently. There's no question about it.
Everything is a political shouting match these days. Everything. Like, how do we get back? How do we get back to civility, to compromise, to not being entrenched in our corners in almost all aspects of life? Mask, no mask, political shouting match. What are we teaching our kids?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not terribly optimistic right now. I think something needs to cause this fever to break, and I don't know what it is at this moment.
You would have thought it might have been the pandemic. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine a more stress. I mean, other than 9/11 in our lifetimes, you would have think it would have been the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't, clearly.
But I do think to some of that, back to the earlier comment about the economic fighting or the economic violence, the pandemic caused a lot of economic destruction, right? I mean, we weren't exactly cruising towards harmony 5 years ago as a country, and we've had contentious elections, and then we get whaled with a pandemic with the shutdown, which is incredibly stressful mentally, emotionally to people, and economically. And that doesn't bode well for harmony as a general rule for societies. It would be nice if our elected leaders could come together and figure out how to lead us through this. But when you have this level of economic disruption, which I don't necessarily see ending anytime soon, I do think it is difficult to pull people together. But it's going to take patience, and it's going to take leadership.
Hey, Joe, I want to sort of tie this to your work. I mean, you know, so listeners know, Trevor mentioned some of your impressive resume. But essentially, from what I understand, reading about you, you were President Trump's number one domestic policy advisor on healthcare. But you were in the White House. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. And so in that role, I mean, you're working the legislative processes to advance agenda. And so I'm just curious, as we talk about this politicization, one of my biggest concerns also is that you just have very few moderates left on both sides of the parties, right? On the Democrats and on the Republicans, that everything is because of various, you know, electoral dynamics. So as you work the agenda for President Trump, things like drug pricing, you know, and obviously other matters, were there enough moderates there? Do you see any faith in sort of the leaders in the Senate and the Congress in terms of, you know, coming together and trying to work on policy and putting politics aside for the better of the nation?
I mean, it's interesting because I spent a lot of time on drug pricing, for instance. I spent a lot of time with Nancy Pelosi's office and leading Democrats, as well as McConnell's office and Schumer's office, trying to steer towards a bipartisan triangulated drug pricing deal to reform Part D and give aligns a lot of the pricing structure and give seniors real relief and really drive prices down over time, or at least the out-of-pocket costs down over time. And I think we were headed that way until the pandemic hit. So I do think there was opportunity in that instance. But back to your original reference when you did the setup question about getting back to bipartisanship, I don't think it should be underestimated, especially you sitting in Boston, what a loss Ted Kennedy was to the biopharmaceutical space. He really spent a lot of time understanding the issues and the policies and amassing a staff around him that was expert in that area and helping to cultivate the environment for the biopharmaceutical industry to prosper. And I don't know another senator on the Democratic side out there that is making the case for innovation, a robust policy space for biopharmaceutical innovation. And you get into this weird thing on the Republican side where there are a few people, I think, who understand it, but it's more a reflexive conservative, I don't like government regulations, I don't like price controls type of response when a reform proposal is put forward.
Hey, Joe, I want to sit on this for a minute because I, you know, Trevor and I, we actually don't talk a lot about biopharma as much on this podcast. And it's clearly a huge issue. It's the center of innovation. I at Bessemer invest in it. Amazing innovations, curative innovations that have come out in the last 5 to 10 years. You've been part of a drug company, I believe Gilead, right? So you have a lot of knowledge. Because on the one hand, you know, frankly, literally curing diseases like cancer and hep C and, you know, really bringing, you know, relief to people who are suffering. So that's amazing. A great example of economic innovation and entrepreneurship in the United States, homegrown, right? On the other hand, the pharma industry just continues to lose this war. I mean, if you think about net promoter scores among the population, it feels like pharma is just losing the battle to explain, you know, why their drugs need to be priced the way they are. I'm curious what your views are on this issue because it's so complex. Like, how do we solve this problem?
How about charging Europe a little bit more and the U.S. a little bit less? Like, the delta between the two is massive, right? Like, I mean, it's crazy how much we spend on pharmaceutical products as compared to our peers in Europe.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And Donald Trump agrees with you. And that was a big part of his pitch in 2016 when he ran. And he most recently did, you know, we had proposed when I was there, this most favored nation, international pricing index model to try and shrink that delta. It is sort of outrageous that a lot of first world economies free ride off American innovation and the American taxpayers in this space. But I must say that I think the pharmaceutical CEOs bear a lot of the blame for this. They're willing to just view Europe and Japan as icing on the cake and that their bread and butter is here made in the United States and not negotiate a little bit more hardball. They'll complain, oh, listen, they're going to compulsory license us. They're going to steal our IP. But there's not a lot of evidence of that taking place. And interestingly, you had a president who was willing to take on big trade fights for the first time in 30 years. And the pharmaceutical industry, if they had played their cards right, could have ridden shotgun with him around some trade fights around getting the Europeans to pay more. But I do think, to your point, they would have had to give here in the United States on some pricing reforms, and they were unwilling to get their head around it. And that's why I think, you know, if you do see a Democratic sweep in November, you're going to see pharma with a big target on its back, and they're going to wish that they had cut a deal in the Trump administration and engaged a little bit more creatively in trying to find a solution.
Curious, I mean, you were his main advisor on this. Where's your head at on this trade-off between, you know, pharma will say, oh, we spend, you know, billions of dollars to create a drug like CAR T and decades long, right, of time. So the cost of capital is even higher. On the other hand, you have folks saying, geez, you know, pricing here is so much more. Is it based on actually a quality of life you're adjusted? Like, where do you come out on this issue of how do you solve this problem and what's the fix?
Yeah, I think the programs have grown so complicated over time. You know, the program's complicated to begin with, and then Congress comes along and they come up with a quote unquote fix that makes it more complicated and frequently creates a whole bunch of new perverse incentives. And you need to start with a blank piece of paper on some of these programs and really start to scrape away a lot of the incentives. I think on the Part B side, you know, we did a fix in that spending bill I referred to in 2019, where we eliminated a lot of the ability of innovative companies to restrict competition from generics by not giving them samples. And that was something that the industry had like war gamed out, and they had figured out we can screw our competitors by using a trick and a loophole legal to keep them from getting samples to our product so they can never make a generic copy. The industry hasn't helped themselves when they do create these patent thickets and all these things. And I think they need to take a step back and fundamentally rethink the way they've engaged the American people with the story, to your point, and the way they engage policymakers to say, hey, listen, there is a social compact here. We make a lot of money. Many of our companies lose a ton and they never make a profit before they go out of business. Many of them who do make a profit, I was at Gilead, we didn't make a profit the first 25 years of existence. But the customer needs to come first. That's the patient. The taxpayer should come second. And then the manufacturer and all the commercial entities in the chain should be third in all these policy debates. And that's not the way it's been. It's been the commercial entities first, the patient second, frequently in the form of a patient group advocating. And then the third is the taxpayer.
It's really funny, Joe. You sound like a Democrat on this. I mean, and maybe this is the point. Like, this is the one place where you could have gotten something done. But what you just said kind of sounds like more of a Democratic position. So maybe this is a place where folks could actually come together and get something done.
Just staying on drug pricing for a second, and I had the opportunity to interview Administrator Verma the other day, and we talked about the bipartisan support around value-based care. I tend to not use the word Obamacare. I use the Affordable Care Act because I think Obamacare politicizes, again, something that doesn't need to be politicized. But do you see a point in time in the future that pharmaceutical products will be priced based on clinical outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, they're headed that way. It's just so early. And then the challenge is, how do you do that? The pricing model that pharma grew up with is, I give the drug to 100 people and it works in 55 of them, or it works in 35 of them, or it works in 12 of them. I've made my money. When you can figure out, we know exactly the 12 people that it's going to work in, and we're only going to give it to those 12 and the other 88 are not going to get it. Are they able to charge that multiple as if they were giving it to 100? I think you're seeing that play out in CAR T and these genetic treatments. It's a very difficult problem to work out. And we are only now wrestling with it, because a $1 million drug or $1.5 million treatment for four kids with something that's horrific in the state of Delaware or in Wyoming or in Iowa could bankrupt a system or a small employer. So how do you figure out how to pay for those things in a rational way, spread the risk, and allow this innovation ecosystem to continue with more targeted therapies and more dramatic clinical outcomes?
So let's keep our good bipartisan work going so far. This has been fun, and I think really helpful to hear your perspective on these things. And Steve, just for the record, did kind of call you a Democrat, so we're gonna stick with that for a second. Let's touch on two things that are highly, highly politicized. One is our response to the onset of COVID-19, coronavirus task force, the kind of sub-task force that was sitting inside the White House. Steve and I know a lot of the guys that were seconded to D.C. to work on that. Just talk to us about, you know, looking back, I know the administration wants to argue that we did the best job we could of the data. Comparative data to other advanced countries, developed nations around the world would not suggest that we did a great job with this. If you had to do things differently, what might you have done differently?
First of all, it's difficult for me to be objective, even with the distance I've got from the White House at this point, because I was there from the very beginning in January when, you know, I started to get concerned based upon what I was seeing out of China and Europe. I think a couple things that people aren't really discussing that is going to need attention in the next few years is, why are institutions failed? I think, you know, the administration's gotten a lot of criticism, some of it valid, some of it not valid. But you look at the amount of money that we devote to NIH, CDC, FDA, and frankly, if every political appointee in the administration had gone down in a plane crash, how would the bureaucracy in and of itself have responded from the beginning? Interestingly, CDC has the best flu teams in the world. There is no question about that. In October of 2019, HHS ran a classified drill around a pandemic flu hitting the United States. Korea ran one on coronavirus. I think an irony out of all this is that we were so focused on flu as a bureaucracy, as a technical expert, that when we got hit with a coronavirus that behaved in ways different than the respiratory characteristics of flu, they were caught flat-footed and it cost us a lot of time. The regulatory shortfalls at FDA have been well documented around the test, also with CDC. One other thing that people aren't talking about is where was NIH? I mean, NIH pays for labs all over the country. They have billions of dollars pumping out looking for various viruses. Why didn't they turn those labs on to look for the virus? That's just an example of early on things that people haven't really focused on. And I think moving forward, we need to revamp CDC, FDA, and NIH. I mean, CDC's data reporting is pathetic. They're still doing things by fax with states. There's no uniformity in data. The mortality data is not uniform across states. We need people, you know, the technology available by iPhones, the advancements and everything that's occurred over the last 20 years. We need to fundamentally rethink how we look for viruses, how we look for contagion from a public health perspective across society, and take a step back in a bipartisan way, sort of like a Pearl Harbor commission, and say, how do we make sure this never happens again? Because to your point, we did not respond in many instances in a way that other countries did. We've underfunded public health for decades in the United States at the state and federal level. CDC's budget is dictated in many instances by Congress. They've gotten involved in all sorts of chronic disease areas that they shouldn't be involved in. They should be focused. Mission one is infectious disease. That is mission critical. Everybody who walks in that door should understand I control infectious diseases. I don't study sugar. I don't study obesity. I control infectious diseases. That is why I was put on this planet. That is why I walk in this building.
I mean, look, I don't disagree that we need to do a lot more on infectious diseases. It would be interesting to look at the overall impact of type 2 diabetes and obesity and the various comorbid conditions, not only on today's healthcare system, but effectively the net present value of the future of the pediatric obesity problem in this country as that population grows up and overwhelms our healthcare system. So in my mind, it's not a matter of one or the other. It's a matter of both.
I disagree with you. I mean, the government can do both, but CDC shouldn't do both. You only have so much ability for the human mind to multitask all these different missions. And you need a CDC director and his senior leadership focused, or her senior leadership focused, on disease control day in and day out, developing the expertise and running the drills. You want to focus on other chronic diseases? That's fine for the government to do that, but it should not be at that institution. These institutions get mission creep all the time. They lose their effectiveness. They lose their edge.
I want to come back to something that Trevor said and sort of end this section on COVID. Why has mask wearing become so politicized? And do you worry the same is going to be true of vaccines?
I don't know why mask wearing has become so politicized, to be honest with you. In the beginning, the data was mixed in the beginning, and that wasn't about preserving PPE. The public health doctrine in the United States was mask wearing for respiratory diseases contributes to infection. That's what the experts advised us. That was uniform. Career, political, everybody said, do not advise wearing masks because you're touching them. They're uncomfortable. They're bringing germs to their face. We quickly pivoted and said, no, the mask is to protect. You wear it to protect other people. And we need to advise them not to touch their mask. And we need to come up with better fitting masks that also control the spread. Then more data came and said, it's not just about infecting other people. It's also about keeping yourself from getting infected. And I think the data continues to roll out that how effective it is. I don't know why it got so politicized. It's bizarre to me.
Do you worry about vaccines?
I do worry about vaccines. It's already started. I mean, it's already started, the politicization of it. You've had people say that they won't take a vaccine that the president has anything to do with. You've got people say that the vaccine development needs to be sped up, or that anybody who wants to adhere to a particular clinical standard is doing it for political purposes. It's extremely unfortunate. And even if it wasn't politicized, the logistics of just getting Americans to take a vaccine like this is going to be very difficult to pull off. The double dose, say, of Pfizer, where it's got to be stored at 70 degrees below zero, and you have to distribute that across the country, that is going to be brutal to pull off. So it will be politicized, and it's very fraught.
We're heading into the second day of confirmation hearings for ACB, and it's almost a certainty that she will be confirmed. I think, obviously, the American Bar Association has said she's highly qualified and credible, political views aside, so this isn't about the politics of it. But I think looming ahead of that is the dismantling of the Affordable Care Act, which had not been accomplished in prior attempts. And so just want to get your thoughts on, you must have been advising President Trump along the way on elements of the Affordable Care Act. He's obviously made it his legacy to dismantle that. And I guess the biggest issue that I'd love to understand is why? Why is this, aside from it being called Obamacare, why is this such a maniacal focus of the Trump administration to undo this legislation?
Well, it didn't have to be. I mean, I do think there were opportunities for bipartisan healthcare legislation to get done. And to be frank, that's always what he wanted in private conversations. He wanted a bipartisan deal on healthcare. I do think people need to take a step back and look at it objectively. We are slated to spend, if we make no changes, $1.8 trillion on Obamacare over the next 10 years. To what end? Is that to get people coverage? Is that to cover people with pre-existing conditions? If the purpose was universal coverage, it frankly has failed. If it was to let people keep their doctor, which was one of the promises, if they so wanted to, that failed. Was it to bring costs down? That was a promise and that failed. So what do you want to accomplish with $1.8 trillion over 10 years? And let's figure out how to repurpose that money and get it done. If it's to cover people with pre-existing conditions, we can do that far more efficiently with that $1.8 trillion. If it is to expand coverage, we can do that by allowing other options for people who want to get tailored coverage for their health care. Not everybody needs the same type of coverage. And the ACA has it as an operating assumption. It all needs to be the same and it all needs to be dictated from Washington, D.C. I happen to not agree with that. I think, you know, I was young and a ski bum at one point in my life. I needed a different level of coverage than I do now, married with kids. It goes back philosophically to, do you believe in centralized control over our insurance industry, or are you more for choice and competition and more options and more innovation in the healthcare system?
It always struck me that this idea of an individual exchange, this is a Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute idea. This was a conservative leaning idea at first, you know, Romney Care in Massachusetts. In every other industry, you bring consumers into it and give them power to make choices that drives down cost, right? So maybe it's a first step, but I think dismantling the ACA, or at least let's just say the individual exchange part of it, it seems ideologically inconsistent to get rid of it. That'd be point number one. And then point number two is the risk pool point, right? Which is, if we want to cover people with pre-existing conditions, you got to have healthy people in the pool. And I worry whether that's going to happen if you drive that policy down at a state level, because there'll be massive differences state by state in terms of the health of those pools, because policies will be different, right?
You're right about the risk pool. There's no question. If you look back to why Medicare was created, right, it was not a commercially viable population to cost effectively deliver healthcare. So you can, as a conservative, embrace this idea of there are some people that have more risk than is commercially viable to insure, people with pre-existing conditions. There are not that many people with pre-existing conditions. The ACA had a risk pool for people with pre-existing conditions set up at the beginning, only a few hundred thousand people set up. It's not 100 million people. You can create a risk pool or have a type of reinsurance for those people with true pre-existing conditions. But to say, here's the deal. We need to have a monster-sized risk pool and create a product that some Americans would not rationally choose to purchase and force them to do so with an individual mandate. That, to me, is just, it's un-American and it doesn't make any sense.
Right, but the mandate's now zero. So this case is, it bewilders me because I understand you guys don't want individual mandates. That's totally cool. Or, you know, okay, that party does it. I'm cool with that, but it's zero. So in effect today, it isn't a mandate, right?
Great. I mean, that's not what California is arguing in the Supreme Court, you realize. California is arguing that the mandate is constitutional, even with zero as the penalty. And Congress has the right to order any American to buy anything that they want to. So it's all well and good to say that the conservative are just being ideological about this. There is ideology all around this. I'm perfectly willing, and I had conversations with Democrats about this on the Hill. Let's focus on people with pre-existing conditions and create a true high-risk pool that could cut across Medicaid, could cut across the small group market, so you don't have an employer with 50 employees get screwed because one employee has two kids with some rare genetic disease and they have to give up healthcare coverage for everybody.
But you have 30 million people. I don't know how many people who got insurance through the exchanges had pre-existing conditions, but you have 30 million people who are otherwise uninsured. And whether or not it was related to a pre-existing condition, show up in an emergency room, no health insurance, end up receiving care in a likely faith-based or not-for-profit hospital, and those organizations then look for alternative ways to raise their prices to offset that, right? I mean, you can call it whatever you want, but at the end of the day, most of these nonprofit hospitals carry a massive amount of effectively charity care. Isn't it advantageous to the system as a whole if that population comes into the emergency room with some form of insurance?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you want more people with some type of coverage. And you also want, frankly, there are some people who would rather go to the emergency room than go get care on a regular basis, which is also a problem.
Really, you know, problematic.
If you have your motivation, you want more people with some type of coverage. I don't think necessarily the solution is to drive up the cost of that coverage and backfill it with subsidies at a certain level of cutoff. The subsidies themselves were very poorly designed, and there's far too many people who get, unless you're really poor, you get really screwed in the middle class the way the ACA is designed.
What's the alternative though, Joe? Like SEMA said last week that they want to provide high quality health care to all Americans, including those with pre-existing conditions, without government intervention. The response to that question is like, how? Where's the plan? What is the proposal here? Because we have this and we have no alternative. And that's what I guess we struggle with.
Well, I think there is a way back to the original premise of the question. Is there a non-ideological way to get there? And what I would focus on is the people with pre-existing conditions who can't be insured in the commercial market and figure out some way with a federal backstop to get all Americans, regardless of their socioeconomic status, some type of reinsurance or risk pool that the federal government backstops and gives some relief to the states and the employers on that side. Then I would focus on restoring the insurance market and its commercial offerings and its ability to innovate at the state level. You could have some type of national catastrophic plan with just actuarial standards so that, like me, back to when I was a ski bum, I could have bought a catastrophic plan to deal with the eventuality of breaking a leg or getting cancer at a young age, which relatively rare, but do that on a cheap basis.
Maybe to wrap up, can I touch upon this lawsuit? Because we started with Bork. Let's end with ACB. I mean, I think the Republicans have, you know, turned the courts around, and I know they've had a concerted effort at it. But let's run down as it relates to ACA. So ACB is appointed. Let's say they hear the case. There's a question of whether the individual mandate is constitutional or not. Then there's a question of, is the law severable? And so I'd love your view on that if you were a justice, because obviously if they rule that it is not severable, that opens up a whole issue of jurisprudence down the line for any law that you could point a hole in and, you know, and get rid of the whole parts of it. One, on that, how you think about that from your ideology. And then two, like, say they decide the whole law gets struck down, exchanges are gone, Medicaid goes down. That strikes me as political suicide for Republicans without a replacement. Do you view like a real odds of like literally, you know, call it Jan 1, 2022, you've got 20 million Americans without coverage? I mean, is that a realistic political outcome that is going to be, you know, digestible by both parties, particularly the Republicans?
No, it's not going to happen. So we should all stop fear-mongering about it. One, Alito and Kavanaugh have written extensively that any federal law should be viewed as severable unless it's impossible not to view it as severable or explicit in the law. It's not explicit in the ACA. That's number one. If they were to strike it down, they would, you know, give it time. They would do a stay for a period of time. You know, it also could be pushed back down to say, hey, listen, what should be teased out? Is it guaranteed issue? Is it pre-existing conditions? Is it universal coverage that goes down with the mandate? Remember, the mandate was viewed as inextricable and is sold as inextricable back to the earlier point about the size of the risk pool needed to make those provisions work.
I agree with that.
But I don't think the other portions of the law would be struck down. And I do think if there was violence done to the law, that it would be an opportunity for bipartisanship to get back to how do we take care of those with pre-existing conditions.
You think in the scenario where it's most scary, you know, is a Biden election. The Democrats are going to keep the House, obviously. The question is the Senate. And so let's say there's a Republican Senate. Let's go to the worst case. Let's say the law is totally struck down. You think that the politicization of this could be separated from actually getting a law done? Conversely, you could imagine a Trump presidency and either, you know, Republican Senate and Democratic House having the same issue. You think something could get done?
Absolutely. Something would have to get done. I mean, for all the reasons you said, I mean, something would get done. And the idea that the whole thing would be struck down is just so far beyond the realm of possibility in my mind that there would be five justices to say the entire law goes down or that it would get struck down and be invalidated immediately. There's like no way to do it, to strike it down immediately. So it would be stayed for an extensive period of time and allow Congress to work something out.
I never thought I'd say that a former member of the Trump administration would provide me such hope. But Joe, I appreciate that.
Hey, Joe, I wish all of our national politicians and I wish everyone could have a civil, informative, really insightful conversation around such complex. Maybe the three of us should
run for office.
Should we run for office? You two, president, vice president, I'll be like social chair. I'll throw the parties and go skiing with you, Joe.
You, interestingly, would probably get the most done. Everybody would be cutting deals with you and coming to see you. And we'd be like, what the hell did we agree to? Oh, you didn't agree to it. But the social chair just cut a deal on the ACA and all our troops are out of Afghanistan.
You had figured out my secret. Joe, this is super, super interesting, incredibly insightful. Thank you so much, A, for tackling some tough questions.
Coming out with two wacky liberals, right?
You know, most of my friends are wacky liberals, so I'm very much
involved. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. I can't help myself. No, I can't help myself.
No, no. Thanks for listening to A Healthy Dose. Please subscribe through iTunes, and if you have any suggestions for topics or guests, please tweet us at A Healthy Dose Pod. Caught up in